That being is seized with pain, suffers, and ceases to exist. Why? It cannot be that there is no answer, and I believe that there is. That's what convinces. That is what has convinced me, said Prince Andrew. Yes, yes, of course, said Pierre. Isn't that what I'm saying? No. All I say is that it is not argument that convinces me of the necessity of a future life, but this. When you go hand in hand with someone, and all at once that person vanishes there, into nowhere, and you yourself are left facing that abyss, and look in. And I have looked in. Well, that's it, then. You know that there is a there, and there is a someone. There is the future life. The someone is God. Prince Andrew did not reply. The carriage and horses had long since been taken off onto the farther bank and reharnessed. The sun had sunk half below the horizon, and an evening frost was starring the puddles near the ferry. But Pierre and Andrew, to the astonishment of the footmen, coachmen, and ferrymen, still stood on the raft and talked. If there is a God in future life, there is truth and good, and man's highest happiness consists in striving to attain them. We must live, we must love, and we must believe that we live not only today on this scrap of earth, but have lived and shall live forever there in the whole, said Pierre, and he pointed to the sky. Prince Andrew stood leaning on the railing of the raft, listening to Pierre, and he gazed with his eyes fixed on the red reflection of the sun gleaming on the blue waters. There was perfect stillness. Pierre became silent. The raft had long since stopped, and only the waves of the current beat softly against it below. Prince Andrew felt as if the sound of the waves kept up a refrain to Pierre's words, whispering, "It is true. Believe it." He sighed and glanced with a radiant, childlike, tender look at Pierre's face, flushed and rapturous, but yet shy before his superior friend. "Yes, if only it was so," said Prince Andrew. "However, it is time to get on," he added. And stepping off the raft, he looked up at the sky to which Pierre had pointed, and for the first time since Austerlitz saw that high, everlasting sky he had seen while lying on that battlefield, and something that had long been slumbering, something that was best within him, suddenly awoke, joyful and youthful in his soul. It vanished as soon as he returned to the customary conditions of his life, but he knew that this feeling which he did not know how to develop existed within him. His meeting with Pierre formed an epoch in Prince Andrew's life. Though outwardly he continued to live in the same old way, inwardly he began a new life. Chapter 11. God's Folk at Bald Hills. Note: Tolstoy has drawn the picture of Princess Mary's intercourse with God's folk from family traditions and personal observations in childhood. Pilgrims such as these, who devoted months, years, or their whole lives to visiting holy places, from Soloviet's monastery in the White Sea to Jerusalem, begging their way from place to place, were quite common in Russia and included a considerable number of maimed, deformed, and mentally defective folk. It was very usual for religious people such as Princess Mary to assist them. They were often harbored at Yasnaya Polyana, especially by Tolstoy's aunt, Countess A. Ostensakin. It was getting dusk when Prince Andrew and Pierre drove up to the front entrance of the house at Bald Hills. As they approached the house, Prince Andrew, with a smile, drew Pierre's attention to a commotion going on at the back porch. A woman, bent with age, with a wallet on her back, and a short, long-haired young man in a black garment, had rushed back to the gate on seeing the carriage driving up. Two women ran out after them, and all four, looking round at the carriage, ran in dismay up the steps of the back porch. "Those are Mary's God's folk," said Prince Andrew. They have mistaken us for my father. This is the one matter in which she disobeys him. He orders these pilgrims to be driven away, but she receives them. But what are God's folk? Asked Pierre. Prince Andrew had no time to answer. The servants came out to meet them, and he asked where the old prince was and whether he was expected back soon. The old prince had gone to the town and was expected back any minute. Prince Andrew led Pierre to his own apartments, which were always kept in perfect order and readiness for him in his father's house. He himself went to the nursery. "Let us go and see my sister," he said to Pierre when he returned. "I have not found her yet. She's hiding now, sitting with her God's folk. It will serve her right. She will be confused. But you will see her God's folk. It's really very curious." "What are God's folk?" asked Pierre. "Come and you'll see for yourself." Princess Mary really was disconcerted, and red patches came on her face when they went in. In her snug room, with lamps burning before the icon stand, a young lad with a long nose and long hair, wearing a monk's cassock, sat on the sofa beside her, behind a samovar. Near them, in an armchair, sat a thin, shriveled old woman with a meek expression on her childlike face. "Andrew, why didn't you warn me?" said the princess, with mild reproach, as she stood before her pilgrims like a hen before her chickens.
"Charmé de vous voir. Je suis très content de vous voir."
"Delighted to see you. I'm very glad to see you," she said to Pierre as he kissed her hand. She had known him as a child, and now his friendship with Andrew, his misfortune with his wife, and above all his kindly, simple face, disposed her favorably toward him. She looked at him with her beautiful, radiant eyes and seemed to say, "I like you very much, but please don't laugh at my people." After exchanging the first greetings, they sat down.
"Ah, and Ivanushka is here, too," said Prince Andrew, glancing with a smile at the young pilgrim.
"Andrew," said Princess Mary imploringly, "il faut que vous sachiez que c'est une femme."
"You must know that this is a woman," said Prince Andrew to Pierre.
"Andrew, au nom de Dieu, for heaven's sake," Princess Mary repeated.
It was evident that Prince Andrew's ironical tone toward the pilgrims and Princess Mary's helpless attempts to protect them were their customary, long-established relations on the matter.
"Mais ma bonne amie."
"But my dear," said Prince Andrew.
"Vous devriez au contraire m'être reconnaissante de ce que j'explique à Pierre votre intimité avec ce jeune homme."
"You ought, on the contrary, to be grateful to me for explaining to Pierre your intimacy with this young man."
"Really?"
said Pierre, gazing over his spectacles with curiosity and seriousness, for which Princess Mary was specially grateful to him, into Ivanushka's face, who, seeing that she was being spoken about, looked round at them all with crafty eyes. Princess Mary's embarrassment on her people's account was quite unnecessary. They were not in the least abashed. The old woman, lowering her eyes, but casting side glances at the newcomers, had turned her cup upside down and placed a nibbled bit of sugar beside it, and sat quietly in her armchair, though hoping to be offered another cup of tea. Ivanushka, sipping out of her saucer, looked with sly womanish eyes from under her brows at the young men.
"Where have you been?"
"To Kiev?" Prince Andrew asked the old woman.
"I have, good sir," she answered garrulously. "Just at Christmas time I was deemed worthy to partake of the holy and heavenly sacrament at the shrine of the saint. And now I'm from Kolyazin, master, where a great and wonderful blessing has been revealed."
"And was Ivanushka with you?"
"I go by myself, benefactor," said Ivanushka, trying to speak in a bass voice. "I only came across Pelageya in Yukhnovo."
Pelageya interrupted her companion. She evidently wished to tell what she had seen.
"In Kolyazin, master, a wonderful blessing has been revealed."
"What is it, some new relics?" asked Prince Andrew.
"Andrew, do leave off," said Princess Mary. "Don't tell him, Pelageya." "No, why not, my dear? Why shouldn't I? I like him. He is kind. He is one of God's chosen. He's a benefactor. He once gave me 10 rubles, I remember. When I was in Kiev, Crazy Cyril says to me, he's one of God's own and goes barefoot summer and winter, he says, 'Why are you not going to the right place? Go to Kolyazin, where a wonder-working icon of the Holy Mother of God has been revealed.' On hearing those words, I said goodbye to the holy folk and went."
All were silent. Only the pilgrim woman went on in measured tones, drawing in her breath.
So I come, master, and the people say to me, a great blessing has been revealed. Holy oil trickles from the cheeks of our blessed mother, the Holy Virgin Mother of God.
All right, all right. You can tell us afterwards, said Princess Mary, flushing.
Let me ask her, said Pierre. Did you see it yourselves? He inquired.
Oh, yes, master. I was found worthy. Such a brightness on the face, like the light of heaven. And from the Blessed Mother's cheek, it drops and drops.
But, dear me, that must be a fraud, said Pierre naively, who had listened attentively to the pilgrim.
Oh, master, what are you saying?
Exclaimed the horrified Pelagea, turning to Princess Mary for support.
They impose on the people, he repeated.
Lord Jesus Christ, exclaimed the pilgrim woman, crossing herself. Oh, don't speak so, master.
There was a general who did not believe and said the monks cheat, and as soon as he'd said it, he went blind. And he dreamed that the Holy Virgin Mother of the Kiev catacombs came to him and said, believe in me and I will make you whole. So he begged, take me to her, take me to her. It's the real truth I'm telling you. I saw it myself. So he was brought, quite blind, straight to her, and he goes up to her and falls down and says, make me whole, says he, and I'll give thee what the Tsar bestowed on me. I saw it myself, master. The star is fixed into the icon. Well, and what do you think? He received his sight. It's a sin to speak so. God will punish you, she said admonishingly, turning to Pierre.
How did the star get into the icon? Pierre asked. And was the Holy Mother promoted to the rank of general? Said Prince Andrew with a smile. Pelagea suddenly grew quite pale and clasped her hands.
Oh, master, master, what a sin! And you who have a son, she began, her pallor suddenly turning to a vivid red. Master, what have you said? God forgive you.
And she crossed herself. Lord, forgive him. My dear, what does it mean? She asked, turning to Princess Mary.
She got up and, almost crying, began to arrange her wallet. She evidently felt frightened and ashamed to have accepted charity in a house where such things could be said, and was at the same time sorry to have now to forego the charity of this house.
Now, why need you do it? Said Princess Mary. Why did you come to me?
Come, Pelagea, I was joking, said Pierre. Princesse, ma parole, je n'ai pas voulu l'offenser.
Princess, on my word, I did not wish to offend her.
I did not mean anything. I was only joking, he said, smiling shyly, and trying to efface his offense.
It was all my fault, and Andrew was only joking.
Pelagea stopped doubtfully, but in Pierre's face there was such a look of sincere penitence, and Prince Andrew glanced so meekly now at her and now at Pierre, that she was gradually reassured. Chapter 12. Old Bolkonski and Pierre. The pilgrim woman was appeased, and being encouraged to talk, gave a long account of Father Amphilochus, who led so holy a life that his hand smelled of incense, and how on her last visit to Kiev, some monks she knew let her have the keys of the catacombs, and how she, taking some dried bread with her, had spent 2 days in the catacombs with the saints.
I'd pray a while to one, ponder a while, then go on to another. I'd sleep a bit, and then again go and kiss the relics. And there was such peace all around, such blessedness, that one don't want to come out, even into the light of heaven again.
Pierre listened to her attentively and seriously. Prince Andrew went out of the room, and then, leaving God's folk to finish their tea, Princess Mary took Pierre into the drawing-room.
You're very kind, she said to him.
Oh, I really did not mean to hurt her feelings. I understand them so well and have the greatest respect for them.
Princess Mary looked at him silently and smiled affectionately.
I've known you a long time, you see, and am as fond of you as of a brother, she said. How do you find Andrew? She added hurriedly, not giving him time to reply to her affectionate words. I'm very anxious about him. His health was better in the winter, but last spring his wound reopened and the doctor said he ought to go away for a cure. And I'm also very much afraid for him spiritually. He has not a character like us women who, when we suffer, can weep away our sorrows. He keeps it all within him. Today he's cheerful and in good spirits, but that is the effect of your visit. He is not often like that. If you could persuade him to go abroad. He needs activity, and this quiet, regular life is very bad for him. Others don't notice it, but I see it. Toward 10 o'clock, the men servants rushed to the front door, hearing the bells of the old prince's carriage approaching. Prince Andrew and Pierre also went out into the porch.
"Who's that?"
asked the old prince, noticing Pierre as he got out of the carriage.
"Ah, very glad. Kiss me,"
he said, having learned who the young stranger was. The old prince was in a good temper and very gracious to Pierre. Before supper, Prince Andrew, coming back to his father's study, found him disputing hotly with his visitor. Pierre was maintaining that a time would come when there would be no more wars. The old prince disputed it chaffingly, but without getting angry.
"Drain the blood from men's veins and put in water instead. Then there will be no more war. Old women's nonsense, old women's nonsense," he repeated.
But still he patted Pierre affectionately on the shoulder, and then went up to the table where Prince Andrew, evidently not wishing to join in the conversation, was looking over the papers his father had brought from town. The old prince went up to him and began to talk business.
"The marshal, Count Rostov, hasn't sent half his contingent. He came to town and wanted to invite me to dinner. I gave him a pretty dinner. And there, look at this. Well, my boy," the old prince went on, addressing his son and patting Pierre on the shoulder, "a fine fellow, your friend. I like him. He stirs me up. Another says clever things and one doesn't care to listen, but this one talks rubbish yet stirs an old fellow up. Well, go, get along. Perhaps I'll come and sit with you at supper. We'll have another dispute. Make friends with my little fool, Princess Mary," he shouted after Pierre through the door.
Only now, on his visit to Bald Hills, did Pierre fully realize the strength and charm of his friendship with Prince Andrew. That charm was not expressed so much in his relations with him as with all his family and with the household. With the stern old prince and the gentle, timid Princess Mary, though he had scarcely known them, Pierre at once felt like an old friend. They were all fond of him already. Not only Princess Mary, who had been won by his gentleness with the pilgrims, gave him her most radiant looks, but even the one-year-old Prince Nicholas, as his grandfather called him, smiled at Pierre and let himself be taken in his arms. And Michael Ivanovich and Mademoiselle Bourienne looked at him with pleasant smiles when he talked to the old prince. The old prince came in to supper. This was evidently on Pierre's account. And during the 2 days of the young man's visit, he was extremely kind to him and told him to visit them again. When Pierre had gone and the members of the household met together, they began to express their opinions of him as people always do after a new acquaintance has left. But as seldom happens, no one said anything but what was good of him. Chapter 13. Nicholas rejoins his regiment. Shortage of provisions. When returning from his leave, Rostov felt for the first time how close was the bond that united him to Denisov and the whole regiment. On approaching it, Rostov felt as he had done when approaching his home in Moscow. When he saw the first hussar with the unbuttoned uniform of his regiment, when he recognized red-haired Dementyev and saw the picket ropes of the roan horses, when Lavrushka gleefully shouted to his master, "The Count has come," and Denisov, who had been asleep on his bed, ran all disheveled out of the mud hut to embrace him, and the officers collected round to greet the new arrival, Rostov experienced the same feeling as when his mother, his father, and his sister had embraced him, and tears of joy choked him so that he could not speak. The regiment was also a home, and as unalterably dear and precious as his parents' house. When he had reported himself to the commander of the regiment and had been reassigned to his former squadron, had been on duty and had gone out foraging, when he had again entered into all the little interests of the regiment and felt himself deprived of liberty and bound in one narrow, unchanging frame, he experienced the same sense of peace
of moral support, and the same sense of being at home here in his own place as he had felt under the parental roof. But here was none of all that turmoil of the world at large, where he did not know his right place and took mistaken decisions. Here was no Sonia with whom he ought or ought not to have an explanation. Here was no possibility of going there or not going there. Here there were not 24 hours in the day which could be spent in such a variety of ways. There was not that innumerable crowd of people of whom not one was nearer to him or farther from him than another. There were none of those uncertain and undefined money relations with his father, and nothing to recall that terrible loss to Dolokhov. Here in the regiment, all was clear and simple. The whole world was divided into two unequal parts. One, our Pavlograd regiment, the other, all the rest. And the rest was no concern of his. In the regiment, everything was definite. Who was lieutenant, who captain, who was a good fellow, who a bad one, and most of all, who was a comrade. The canteen keeper gave one credit. One's pay came every 4 months. There was nothing to think out or decide. You had only to do nothing that was considered bad in the Pavlograd regiment, and when given an order to do what was clearly, distinctly, and definitely ordered, and all would be well. Having once more entered into the definite conditions of this regimental life, Rostov felt the joy and relief a tired man feels on lying down to rest. Life in the regiment during this campaign was all the pleasanter for him because, after his loss to Dolokhov, for which, in spite of all his family's efforts to console him, he could not forgive himself, he had made up his mind to atone for his fault by serving not as he had done before, but really well, and by being a perfectly first-rate comrade and officer. In a word, a splendid man altogether, a thing which seemed so difficult out in the world, but so possible in the regiment. After his losses, he had determined to pay back his debt to his parents in 5 years. He received 10,000 rubles a year, but now resolved to take only 2,000 and leave the rest to repay the debt to his parents. Our army, after repeated retreats and advances, and battles at Pultusk and Preußisch Eylau, was concentrated near Bartenstein. It was awaiting the Emperor's arrival and the beginning of a new campaign. The Pavlograd regiment, belonging to that part of the army which had served in the 1805 campaign, had been recruiting up to strength in Russia, and arrived too late to take part in the first actions of the campaign. It had been neither at Pultusk nor at Preußisch Eylau, and when it joined the army in the field in the second half of the campaign, was attached to Platov's division. Platov's division was acting independently of the main army. Several times parts of the Pavlograd regiment had exchanged shots with the enemy, had taken prisoners, and once had even captured Marshal Widinov's carriages. In April, the Pavlograds were stationed immovably for some weeks near a totally ruined and deserted German village. A thaw had set in. It was muddy and cold, the ice on the river broke, and the roads became impassable. For days, neither provisions for the men nor fodder for the horses had been issued. Note. In his description of the wars of 1806-7, Mikhailovsky Danilevsky says, "The lack of grain in spring occasioned the slackness of the higher command and its inability to stop abuses which made their way into the management of the commissariat." In reply to a report of hunger in the army, Bennigsen once replied, "It is necessary to know how to endure. I only have 3 dishes for my own dinner." Money was issued to buy provisions, but money cannot buy provisions where there are none. Sometimes the generals seized each other's provision wagons almost by assault, and bread seldom reached Bennigsen's advanced guard. Soldiers swelled up and died of hunger. The hospitals were in a wretched condition. As no transports could arrive, the men dispersed about the abandoned and deserted villages searching for potatoes, but found few even of these. Everything had been eaten up, and the inhabitants had all fled. If any remained, they were worse than beggars, and nothing more could be taken from them. Even the soldiers, usually pitiless enough, instead of taking anything from them,
often gave them the last of their rations.
The Pavlograd regiment had had only 2 men wounded in action, but had lost nearly half its men from hunger and sickness. In the hospitals, death was so certain that soldiers suffering from fever or the swelling that came from bad food preferred to remain on duty, and, hardly able to drag their legs, went to the front rather than to the hospitals. When spring came on, the soldiers found a plant just showing out of the ground that looked like asparagus, which for some reason they called Mashka's sweet root. It was very bitter, but they wandered about the field seeking it and dug it out with their sabers and ate it, though they were ordered not to do so as it was a noxious plant. That spring a new disease broke out among the soldiers, a swelling of the arms, legs, and face, which the doctors attributed to eating this root. But in spite of all this, the soldiers of Denisov's squadron fed chiefly on Mashka's sweet root, because it was the second week that the last of the biscuits were being doled out at the rate of 1/2 pound a man, and the last potatoes received had sprouted and frozen. The horses also had been fed for a fortnight on straw from the thatched roofs, and had become terribly thin, though still covered with tufts of felty winter hair. Despite this destitution, the soldiers and officers went on living just as usual. Despite their pale, swollen faces and tattered uniforms, the hussars formed line for roll call, kept things in order, groomed their horses, polished their arms, brought in straw from the thatched roofs in place of fodder, and sat down to dine round the cauldrons from which they rose up hungry, joking about their nasty food and their hunger. As usual, in their spare time, they lit bonfires, steamed themselves before them naked, smoked, picked out and baked sprouting rotten potatoes, told and listened to stories of Potyomkin's and Suvorov's campaigns, or to legends of Alyosha the Sly, or the priest's laborer Mikolka. The officers, as usual, lived in 2s and 3s in the roofless, half-ruined houses. The seniors tried to collect straw and potatoes, and, in general, food for the men. The younger ones occupied themselves as before, some playing cards. There was plenty of money, though there was no food. Some with more innocent games, such as quoits and skittles. The general trend of the campaign was rarely spoken of, partly because nothing certain was known about it, partly because there was a vague feeling that, in the main, it was going badly. Rostov lived, as before, with Denisov, and since their furlough they had become more friendly than ever. Denisov never spoke of Rostov's family, but by the tender friendship his commander showed him, Rostov felt that the elder hussar's luckless love for Natasha played a part in strengthening their friendship. Denisov evidently tried to expose Rostov to danger as seldom as possible, and after an action greeted his safe return with evident joy. On one of his foraging expeditions, in a deserted and ruined village to which he had come in search of provisions, Rostov found a family consisting of an old Pole and his daughter with an infant in arms. They were half-clad, hungry, too weak to get away on foot, and had no means of obtaining a conveyance. Rostov brought them to his quarters, placed them in his own lodging, and kept them for some weeks while the old man was recovering. One of his comrades, talking of women, began chaffing Rostov, saying that he was more wily than any of them, and that it would not be a bad thing if he introduced to them the pretty Polish girl he had saved. Rostov took the joke as an insult, flared up, and said such unpleasant things to the officer that it was all Denisov could do to prevent a duel. When the officer had gone away, Denisov, who did not himself know what Rostov's relations with the Polish girl might be, began to upbraid him for his quickness of temper. And Rostov replied, "Say what you like. She's like a sister to me, and I can't tell you how it offended me because, well, for that reason." Denisov patted him on the shoulder and began rapidly pacing the room without looking at Rostov, as was his way at moments of deep feeling. "What a mad weed you Rostovs are," he muttered, and Rostov noticed tears in his eyes. Chapter 14. Denisov seizes transports of food, gets into trouble, is wounded. In April, the troops were enlivened by news of the emperor's arrival. But Rostov had no chance of being present at the review he held at Bartenstein, as the Pavlograds were at the outposts far beyond that place. They were bivouacking. Denisov and Rostov were living in an earth hut dug out for them by the soldiers and roofed with branches and turf. The hut was made in the following manner, which had then come into vogue. A trench was dug 3.5 feet wide, 4 feet 8 inches deep, and 8 feet long. At one end of the trench, steps were cut out, and these formed the entrance and vestibule. The trench itself was the room in which the lucky one, such as the squadron commander, had a board lying on piles at the end opposite the entrance to serve as a table. On each side of the trench, the earth was cut out to a breadth of about 2.5 feet, and this did duty for bedsteads and couches. The roof was so constructed that one could stand up in the middle of the trench and could even sit up on the beds if one drew close to the table. Denisov, who was living luxuriously because the soldiers of his squadron liked him, had also a board in the roof at the farther end with a piece of broken but mended glass in it for a window. When it was very cold, embers from the soldiers' campfire were placed on a bent sheet of iron on the steps in the reception room, as Denisov called that part of the hut, and it was then so warm that the officers, of whom there were always some with Denisov and Rostov, sat in their shirt sleeves. In April, Rostov was on orderly duty. One morning, between 7 and 8, returning after a sleepless night, he sent for embers, changed his rain-soaked underclothes, said his prayers, drank tea, got warm, then tidied up the things on the table and in his own corner, and, his face glowing from exposure to the wind and with nothing on but his shirt, lay down on his back, putting his arms under his head. He was pleasantly considering the probability of being promoted in a few days for his last reconnoitering expedition, and was awaiting Denisov, who had gone out somewhere and with whom he wanted to talk. Suddenly he heard Denisov shouting in a vibrating voice behind the hut, evidently much excited. Rostov moved to the window to see whom he was speaking to, and saw the quartermaster, Topchayenko.
"I ordered you not to let them eat that Mashka Woot stuff," Denisov was shouting, "and I saw with my own eyes how Lazarchuk brought some from the fields."
"I've given the order again and again, Your Honor, but they don't obey," answered the quartermaster.
Rostov lay down again on his bed and thought complacently, "Let him fuss and bustle now. My job's done and I'm lying down. Capitally." He could hear that Lavrushka, that sly, bold orderly of Denisov's, was talking as well as the quartermaster. Lavrushka was saying something about loaded wagons, biscuits, and oxen he had seen when he had gone out for provisions. Then Denisov's voice was heard shouting farther and farther away,
"Saddle! Second platoon!"
Where are they off to now? Thought Rostov. 5 minutes later, Denisov came into the hut, climbed with muddy boots on the bed, lit his pipe, furiously scattered his things about, took his leaded whip, buckled on his saber, and went out again. In answer to Rostov's inquiry where he was going, he answered vaguely and crossly that he had some business.
"Let God and our great monarch judge me afterwards," said Denisov, going out,
and Rostov heard the hoofs of several horses splashing through the mud. He did not even trouble to find out where Denisov had gone. Having got warm in his corner, he fell asleep and did not leave the hut till toward evening. Denisov had not yet returned. The weather had cleared up, and near the next hut, two officers and a cadet were playing spike, quoits, laughing as they threw their missiles, which buried themselves in the soft mud. Rostov joined them. In the middle of the game, the officers saw some wagons approaching with 15 hussars on their skinny horses behind them. The wagons, escorted by the hussars, drew up to the picket ropes, and a crowd of hussars surrounded them.
"There now, Denisov has been worrying," said Rostov, "and here are the provisions."
"So they are," said the officers. "Won't the soldiers be glad?"
A little behind the hussars came Denisov, accompanied by two infantry officers with whom he was talking. Rostov went to meet them.
"I warn you, Captain," one of the officers, a short, thin man, evidently very angry, was saying. "Haven't I told you I won't give them up?
replied Denisov.
You will answer for it, Captain. It is mutiny, seizing the transport of one's own army. Our men have had nothing to eat for 2 days.
And mine have had nothing for 2 weeks, said Denisov.
It is robbery. You'll answer for it, sir,
said the infantry officer, raising his voice.
Oh, what are you pestering me for?
Cried Denisov, suddenly losing his temper.
I shall answer for it, and not you, and you'd better not buzz about here till you get hurt. Be off, go!
He shouted at the officers.
Very well, then, shouted the little officer, undaunted and not riding away. If you're determined to rob, I'll... Go to the devil! Quick march while you're safe and sound.
And Denisov turned his horse on the officer.
Very well, very well, muttered the officer threateningly. And turning his horse, he trotted away, jolting in his saddle.
A dog astride a fence! A wheel dog astride a fence!
Shouted Denisov after him, the most insulting expression a cavalryman can address to a mounted infantryman. And riding up to Rostov, he burst out laughing.
I've taken transports from the infantry by force, he said. After all, can't let our men starve.
The wagons that had reached the Hussars had been consigned to an infantry regiment, but learning from Lavrushka that the transport was unescorted, Denisov with his Hussars had seized it by force. The soldiers had biscuits dealt out to them freely, and they even shared them with the other squadrons. The next day, the regimental commander sent for Denisov, and holding his fingers spread out before his eyes, said, This is how I look at this affair. I know nothing about it, and won't begin proceedings. But I advise you to ride over to the staff and settle the business there in the commissariat department, and if possible, sign a receipt for such and such stores received. If not, as the demand was booked against an infantry regiment, there will be a row and the affair may end badly. From the regimental commanders, Denisov rode straight to the staff with a sincere desire to act on this advice. In the evening, he came back to his dugout in a state such as Rostov had never yet seen him in. Denisov could not speak and gasped for breath. When Rostov asked what was the matter, he only uttered some incoherent oaths and threats in a hoarse, feeble voice. Alarmed at Denisov's condition, Rostov suggested that he should undress, drink some water, and send for the doctor.
Try me for wobbly. Ugh. Some water, some more water. Let them twy me, but I'll always thrash scoundrels, and I'll tell the Emperor. Ice, he muttered.
The regimental doctor, when he came, said it was absolutely necessary to bleed Denisov. A deep saucer of black blood was taken from his hairy arm, and only then was he able to relate what had happened to him.
I get there, began Denisov. Now then, where's your chief's quarters? They were pointed out. Please to wait. I've ridden 20 miles and have duties to attend to, and no time to wait. Announce me. Very well, so out comes their head chief. Also took it into his head to lecture me. It's wobbly. Wobbly, I say, is not done by a man who sees his provisions to feed his soldiers, but by him who takes them to fill his own pockets. Will you please be silent? Very good. Then he says, go and give a receipt to the commissioner, but your affair will be passed on to headquarters. I go to the commissioner. I enter, and at the table, who do you think?
No, but wait a bit. Who is it that's starving us?
Shouted Denisov, hitting the table with the fist of his newly bled arm so violently that the table nearly broke down and the tumblers on it jumped about.
Telyanin! What? So it's you who's starving us to death, is it? Take this and this. And I hit him so pat, straight on his snout. And I started thrashing him. Well, I've had a bit of fun, I can tell you,
cried Denisov, gleeful and yet angry, his white teeth showing under his black mustache.
I'd have killed him if they hadn't taken him away. But what are you shouting for? Calm yourself, said Rostov. You've set your arm bleeding afresh. Wait, we must tie it up again.
Denisov was bandaged up again and put to bed. Next day, he woke calm and cheerful. But at noon, the adjutant of the regiment came into Rostov's and Denisov's dugout with a grave and serious face and regretfully showed them a paper addressed to Major Denisov from the regimental commander in which inquiries were made about yesterday's occurrence. The adjutant told them that the affair was likely to take a very bad turn, that a court-martial had been appointed, and that, in view of the severity with which marauding and insubordination were now regarded, degradation to the ranks would be the best that could be hoped for. The case, as represented by the offended parties, was that after seizing the transports, Major Denisov, being drunk, went to the chief quartermaster, and without any provocation called him a thief, threatened to strike him, and on being led out had rushed into the office and given two officials a thrashing and dislocated the arm of one of them. In answer to Rostov's renewed questions, Denisov said laughing that he thought he remembered that some other fellow had got mixed up in it, but that it was all nonsense and rubbish, and he did not in the least fear any kind of trial, and that if those scoundrels dared attack him, he would give them an answer that they would not easily forget. Denisov spoke contemptuously of the whole affair, but Rostov knew him too well not to detect that, while hiding it from others, at heart he feared a court-martial and was worried over the affair, which was evidently taking a bad turn. Every day letters of inquiry and notices from the court arrived, and on the 1st of May, Denisov was ordered to hand the squadron over to the next in seniority and appear before the staff of his division to explain his violence at the commissariat office. On the previous day, Platov reconnoitred with two Cossack regiments and two squadrons of hussars. Denisov, as was his wont, rode out in front of the outposts, parading his courage. A bullet fired by a French sharpshooter hit him in the fleshy part of his leg. Perhaps at another time Denisov would not have left the regiment for so slight a wound, but now he took advantage of it to excuse himself from appearing at the staff and went into hospital. Chapter 15. Nicholas visits Denisov in hospital. In June, the Battle of Friedland was fought, in which the Pavlograds did not take part, and after that an armistice was proclaimed. Rostov, who felt his friend's absence very much, having no news of him since he left, and feeling very anxious about his wound and the progress of his affairs, took advantage of the armistice to get leave to visit Denisov in hospital. The hospital was in a small Prussian town that had been twice devastated by Russian and French troops. Because it was summer, when it is so beautiful out in the fields, the little town presented a particularly dismal appearance, with its broken roofs and fences, its foul streets, tattered inhabitants, and the sick and drunken soldiers wandering about. The hospital was in a brick building, with some of the window frames and panes broken, and a courtyard surrounded by the remains of a wooden fence that had been pulled to pieces. Several bandaged soldiers with pale, swollen faces were sitting or walking about in the sunshine in the yard. Directly Rostov entered the door, he was enveloped by a smell of putrefaction and hospital air. On the stairs he met a Russian army doctor smoking a cigar. The doctor was followed by a Russian assistant. "I can't tear myself to pieces," the doctor was saying. "Come to Makar Alexeyevich in the evening. I shall be there." The assistant asked some further questions. "Oh, do the best you can. Isn't it all the same?" The doctor noticed Rostov coming upstairs. "What do you want, sir?" said the doctor. "What do you want? The bullets having spared you, do you want to try typhus? This is a pest house, sir." "How so?" asked Rostov. "Typhus, sir. It's death to go in. Only we two, Makeyev and I," he pointed to the assistant, "keep on here. Some five of us doctors have died in this place. When a new one comes, he's done for in a week," said the doctor with evident satisfaction. "Prussian doctors have been invited here, but our allies don't like it at all." Rostov explained that he wanted to see Major Denisov of the Hussars, who was wounded. "I don't know. I can't tell you, sir. Only think, I'm alone in charge of three hospitals with more than 400 patients. It's well that the charitable Prussian ladies send us 2 pounds of coffee and some lint each month, or we should be lost." He laughed. 400, sir, and they're always sending me fresh ones. There are 400, eh?" he asked, turning to the assistant. The assistant looked fagged out. He was evidently vexed and impatient for the talkative doctor to go. "Major Denisov," Rostov said again. "He was wounded at Molitin." "Dead, I fancy. Eh, Makeyev?" queried the doctor in a tone of indifference. The assistant, however, did not confirm the doctor's words. "Is he tall and with reddish hair?" asked the doctor. Rostov described Denisov's appearance. "There was one like that," said the doctor, as if pleased. "That one is dead, I fancy. However, I'll look up our list. We had a list. You got it, Makeyev?
Makar Alexeyevich has the list, answered the assistant. But if you'll step into the officer's wards, you'll see for yourself, he added, turning to Rostov.
Ah, you'd better not go, sir, said the doctor, or you may have to stay here yourself.
But Rostov bowed himself away from the doctor and asked the assistant to show him the way.
Only don't blame me, the doctor shouted up after him.
Rostov and the assistant went into the dark corridor. The smell was so strong there that Rostov held his nose and had to pause and collect his strength before he could go on. A door opened to the right, and an emaciated, sallow man on crutches, barefoot and in underclothing, limped out and, leaning against the doorpost, looked with glittering, envious eyes at those who were passing. Glancing in at the door, Rostov saw that the sick and wounded were lying on the floor on straw and overcoats.
May I go in and look?
What is there to see? Said the assistant. But just because the assistant evidently did not want him to go in, Rostov entered the soldier's ward. The foul air, to which he had already begun to get used in the corridor, was still stronger here. It was a little different, more pungent, and one felt that this was where it originated. In the long room, brightly lit up by the sun through the large windows, the sick and wounded lay in two rows with their heads to the walls and leaving a passage in the middle. Most of them were unconscious and paid no attention to the newcomers. Those who were conscious raised themselves or lifted their thin yellow faces and all looked intently at Rostov with the same expression of hope, of relief, reproach, and envy of another's help. Rostov went to the middle of the room and, looking through the open doors into the two adjoining rooms, saw the same thing there. He stood still, looking silently around. He had not at all expected such a sight. Just before him, almost across the middle of the passage, on the bare floor, lay a sick man, probably a Cossack to judge by the cut of his hair. The man lay on his back, his huge arms and legs outstretched. His face was purple. His eyes were rolled back so that only the whites were seen, and on his bare legs and arms, which were still red, the veins stood out like cords. He was knocking the back of his head against the floor, hoarsely uttering some word which he kept repeating. Rostov listened and made out the word. It was,
drink, drink, a drink.
Rostov glanced round, looking for someone who would put this man back in his place and bring him water. Who looks after the sick here? He asked the assistant. Just then a commissariat soldier, a hospital orderly, came in from the next room, marching stiffly, and drew up in front of Rostov.
Good day, Your Honor, he shouted, rolling his eyes at Rostov and evidently mistaking him for one of the hospital authorities.
Get him to his place and give him some water, said Rostov, pointing to the Cossack.
Yes, Your Honor, the soldier replied complacently, and rolling his eyes more than ever, he drew himself up still straighter, but did not move.
No, it's impossible to do anything here, thought Rostov, lowering his eyes. And he was going out, but became aware of an intense look fixed on him on his right, and he turned. Close to the corner, on an overcoat, sat an old, unshaven, gray-bearded soldier as thin as a skeleton, with a stern, sallow face and eyes intently fixed on Rostov. The man's neighbor on one side whispered something to him, pointing at Rostov, who noticed that the old man wanted to speak to him. He drew nearer and saw that the old man had only one leg bent under him, the other had been amputated above the knee. His neighbor on the other side, who lay motionless some distance from him with his head thrown back, was a young soldier with a snub nose. His pale, waxen face was still freckled, and his eyes were rolled back. Rostov looked at the young soldier, and a cold chill ran down his back.
Why, this one seems, he began, turning to the assistant.
And how we've been begging, Your Honor, said the old soldier, his jaw quivering. He's been dead since morning. After all, we're men, not dogs.
I'll send someone at once. He shall be taken away at once, said the assistant hurriedly. Let us go, Your Honor.
Yes, yes, let us go, said Rostov hastily. And lowering his eyes and shrinking,
He tried to pass unnoticed between the rows of reproachful, envious eyes that were fixed upon him, and went out of the room. Going along the corridor, the assistant led Rostov to the officers' wards, consisting of three rooms, the doors of which stood open. There were beds in these rooms, and the sick and wounded officers were lying or sitting on them. Some were walking about the rooms in hospital dressing gowns. The first person Rostov met in the officers' ward was a thin little man with one arm, who was walking about the first room in a nightcap and hospital dressing gown, with a pipe between his teeth. Rostov looked at him, trying to remember where he had seen him before.
"See where we've met again," said the little man. Tushin, don't you remember, who gave you a lift at Schöngraben? And I've had a bit cut off, you see," he went on with a smile, pointing to the empty sleeve of his dressing gown. "Looking for Vasily Dmitrich Denisov? My neighbor," he added, when he heard who Rostov wanted. Here. And Tushin led him into the next room, from whence came sounds of several laughing voices. "How can they laugh, or even live at all here?" thought Rostov, still aware of that smell of decomposing flesh that had been so strong in the soldiers' ward, and still seeming to see fixed on him those envious looks which had followed him out from both sides, and the face of that young soldier with eyes rolled back. Denisov lay asleep on his bed, with his head under the blanket, though it was nearly noon.
"Oh, Rostov, how are you? How are you?" he called out, still in the same voice as in the regiment.
But Rostov noticed sadly that under this habitual ease and animation, some new, sinister, hidden feeling showed itself in the expression of Denisov's face and the intonations of his voice. His wound, though a slight one, had not yet healed, even now, 6 weeks after he had been hit. His face had the same swollen pallor as the faces of the other hospital patients. But it was not this that struck Rostov. What struck him was that Denisov did not seem glad to see him, and smiled at him unnaturally. He did not ask about the regiment, nor about the general state of affairs, and when Rostov spoke of these matters, did not listen. Rostov even noticed that Denisov did not like to be reminded of the regiment, or in general of that other free life which was going on outside the hospital. He seemed to try to forget that old life, and was only interested in the affair with the commissariat officers. On Rostov's inquiry as to how the matter stood, he at once produced from under his pillow a paper he had received from the commission and the rough draft of his answer to it. He became animated when he began reading his paper, and specially drew Rostov's attention to the stinging rejoinders he made to his enemies. His hospital companions, who had gathered round Rostov, a fresh arrival from the world outside, gradually began to disperse as soon as Denisov began reading his answer. Rostov noticed by their faces that all those gentlemen had already heard that story more than once and were tired of it. Only the man who had the next bed, a stout Uhlan, continued to sit on his bed, gloomily frowning and smoking a pipe, and little one-armed Tushin still listened, shaking his head disapprovingly. In the middle of the reading, the Uhlan interrupted Denisov. "But what I say is," he said, turning to Rostov, "it would be best simply to petition the Emperor for pardon. They say great rewards will now be distributed, and surely a pardon would be granted."
"Me petition the Emperor?"
exclaimed Denisov, in a voice to which he tried hard to give the old energy and fire, but which sounded like an expression of irritable impotence.
"What for? If I were a robber, I would ask mercy, but I'm being court-martialed for bringing robbers to book. Let them twine me. I'm not afraid of anyone. I've served the Tsar and my country honorably, and have not stolen. And am I to be degraded? Listen, I'm writing to him straight. This is what I say. If I had robbed the treasury..."
"It's certainly well written," said Tushin. "But that's not the point, Vasily Dmitrich." And he also turned to Rostov. "One has to submit, and Vasily Dmitrich doesn't want to. You know the auditor told you it was a bad business."
"Well, let it be bad," said Denisov.
"The auditor wrote out a petition for you," continued Tushin, "and you ought to sign it and ask this gentleman to take it. No doubt he," indicating Rostov, "has connections on the staff. You won't find a better opportunity."
Haven't I said I'm not going to grovel?
Denisov interrupted him and went on reading the paper. Rostov had not the courage to persuade Denisov, though he instinctively felt that the way advised by Tushin and the other officers was the safest, and though he would have been glad to be of service to Denisov. He knew his stubborn will and straightforward, hasty temper. When the reading of Denisov's virulent reply, which took more than an hour, was over, Rostov said nothing, and he spent the rest of the day in a most dejected state of mind amid Denisov's hospital comrades, who had gathered round him, telling them what he knew and listening to their stories. Denisov was moodily silent all the evening. Late in the evening, when Rostov was about to leave, he asked Denisov whether he had no commission for him.
"Yes, wait a bit," said Denisov, glancing round at the officers,
and, taking his papers from under his pillow, he went to the window where he had an inkpot and sat down to write.
"It seems it's no use knocking one's head against a wall," he said, coming from the window and giving Rostov a large envelope.
In it was the petition to the Emperor drawn up by the auditor, in which Denisov, without alluding to the offences of the commissariat officials, simply asked for pardon.
"Hand it in. It seems..."
He did not finish, but gave a painfully unnatural smile. Chapter 16. Boris at Tilsit. Nicholas's inopportune visit. Having returned to the regiment and told the commander the state of Denisov's affairs, Rostov rode to Tilsit with a letter to the emperor. On the 13th of June, the French and Russian emperors arrived in Tilsit. Boris Drubetskoy had asked the important personage on whom he was in attendance to include him in the suite appointed for the stay at Tilsit. "I should like to see the great man," he said, alluding to Napoleon, whom hitherto he, like everyone else, had always called Buonaparte.
"You are speaking of Buonaparte?" asked the general, smiling.
Boris looked at his general inquiringly and immediately saw that he was being tested. "I am speaking, Prince, of the Emperor Napoleon," he replied. The general patted him on the shoulder with a smile.
"He will go far," he said,
and took him to Tilsit with him. Boris was among the few present at the Niemen on the day the two emperors met. He saw the raft decorated with monograms, saw Napoleon pass before the French guards on the farther bank of the river, saw the pensive face of the Emperor Alexander as he sat in silence in a tavern on the bank of the Niemen awaiting Napoleon's arrival, saw both emperors get into boats, and saw how Napoleon, reaching the raft first, stepped quickly forward to meet Alexander and held out his hand to him, and how they both retired into the pavilion. Since he had begun to move in the highest circles, Boris had made it his habit to watch attentively all that went on around him and to note it down. At the time of the meeting at Tilsit, he asked the names of those who had come with Napoleon and about the uniforms they wore, and listened attentively to words spoken by important personages. At the moment the emperors went into the pavilion, he looked at his watch and did not forget to look at it again when Alexander came up. The interview had lasted an hour and 53 minutes. He noted this down that same evening, among other facts he felt to be of historic importance. As the emperor's suite was a very small one, it was a matter of great importance for a man who valued his success in the service to be at Tilsit on the occasion of this interview between the two emperors, and having succeeded in this, Boris felt that henceforth his position was fully assured. He had not only become known, but people had grown accustomed to him and accepted him. Twice he had executed commissions to the emperor himself, so that the latter knew his face. And all those at court, far from cold-shouldering him, as at first when they considered him a newcomer, would now have been surprised had he been absent. Boris lodged with another adjutant, the Polish Count Zhilinski. Zhilinski, a Pole brought up in Paris, was rich and passionately fond of the French, and almost every day of the stay at Tilsit, French officers of the Guard and from French headquarters were dining and lunching with him and Boris. On the evening of the 24th of June, Count Zhilinski arranged a supper for his French friends. The guest of honor was an aide-de-camp of Napoleon's. There were also several French officers of the Guard, and a page of Napoleon's, a young lad of an old aristocratic French family. That same day, Rostov, profiting by the darkness to avoid being recognized in civilian dress, came to Tilsit and went to the lodging occupied by Boris and Zhilinsky. Rostov, in common with the whole army from which he came, was far from having experienced the change of feeling toward Napoleon and the French, who from being foes had suddenly become friends, that had taken place at headquarters and in Boris. In the army, Bonaparte and the French were still regarded with mingled feelings of anger, contempt, and fear. Only recently, talking with one of Platov's Cossack officers, Rostov had argued that if Napoleon were taken prisoner, he would be treated not as a sovereign, but as a criminal. Quite lately, happening to meet a wounded French colonel on the road, Rostov had maintained with heat that peace was impossible between a legitimate sovereign and the criminal Bonaparte. Rostov was therefore unpleasantly struck by the presence of French officers in Boris's lodging, dressed in uniforms he had been accustomed to see from quite a different point of view from the outposts of the flank. As soon as he noticed a French officer who thrust his head out of the door, that warlike feeling of hostility which he always experienced at the sight of the enemy suddenly seized him. He stopped at the threshold and asked in Russian whether Drubetskoy lived there. Boris, hearing a strange voice in the anteroom, came out to meet him. An expression of annoyance showed itself for a moment on his face on first recognizing Rostov.
"Ah, it's you. Very glad to see you," he said, however, coming toward him with a smile.
But Rostov had noticed his first impulse.
"I've come at a bad time, I think. I should not have come, but I have business," he said coldly.
"No, I only wonder how you managed to get away from your regiment. Dans un moment, je suis à vous."
"In a minute I shall be at your disposal," he said, answering someone who called him.
"I see I'm intruding," Rostov repeated. The look of annoyance had already disappeared from Boris's face. Having evidently reflected and decided how to act, he very quietly took both Rostov's hands and led him into the next room. His eyes, looking serenely and steadily at Rostov, seemed to be veiled by something, as if screened by blue spectacles of conventionality. So it seemed to Rostov.
"Oh, come now, as if you could come at a wrong time," said Boris,
and he led him into the room where the supper table was laid and introduced him to his guests, explaining that he was not a civilian, but an hussar officer and an old friend of his.
"Count Zhilinsky, le comte N.N., le capitaine S.S.," said he, naming his guests.
Rostov looked frowningly at the Frenchman, bowed reluctantly, and remained silent. Zhilinsky evidently did not receive this new Russian person very willingly into his circle, and did not speak to Rostov. Boris did not appear to notice the constraint the newcomer produced, and with the same pleasant composure and the same veiled look in his eyes with which he had met Rostov, tried to enliven the conversation. One of the Frenchmen, with the politeness characteristic of his countrymen, addressed the obstinately taciturn Rostov, saying that the latter had probably come to Tilsit to see the Emperor.
"No, I came on business," replied Rostov briefly.
Rostov had been out of humor from the moment he noticed the look of dissatisfaction on Boris's face, and as always happens to those in a bad humor, it seemed to him that everyone regarded him with aversion and that he was in everybody's way. He really was in their way, for he alone took no part in the conversation, which again became general. The looks the visitors cast on him seemed to say, "And what is he sitting here for?" He rose and went up to Boris.
"Anyhow, I'm in your way," he said in a low tone. "Come and talk over my business and I'll go away."
"Oh, no, not at all," said Boris.
"But if you're tired, come and lie down in my room and have a rest."
"Yes, really."
They went into the little room where Boris slept. Rostov, without sitting down, began at once, irritably, as if Boris were to blame in some way, telling him about Denisov's affair, asking him whether through his general he could and would intercede with the Emperor on Denisov's behalf and get Denisov's petition handed in. When he and Boris were alone, Rostov felt for the first time that he could not look Boris in the face without a sense of awkwardness. Boris, with one leg crossed over the other and stroking his left hand with the slender fingers of his right, listened to Rostov as a general listens to the report of a subordinate, now looking aside and now gazing straight into Rostov's eyes with the same veiled look. Each time this happened, Rostov felt uncomfortable and cast down his eyes. I have heard of such cases, and know that His Majesty is very severe in such affairs. I think it would be best not to bring it before the Emperor, but to apply to the commander of the corps. But in general, I think... So you don't want to do anything? Well, then say so. Rostov almost shouted, not looking Boris in the face. Boris smiled. On the contrary, I will do what I can. Only I thought... At that moment, Zhilinsky's voice was heard calling Boris. Well, then go, 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 said Rostov. And refusing supper and remaining alone in the little room, he walked up and down for a long time, hearing the light-hearted French conversation from the next room. Chapter 17. Nicholas tries to present Denisov's petition at the Emperor's residence, but fails. Rostov had come to Tilsit on the day least suitable for a petition on Denisov's behalf. He could not himself go to the general in attendance, as he was in mufti and had come to Tilsit without permission to do so, and Boris, even had he wished to, could not have done so on the following day. On that day, June 27th, the preliminaries of peace were signed. The emperors exchanged decorations. Alexander received the cross of the Legion of Honor, and Napoleon the Order of St. Andrew of the First Degree, and a dinner had been arranged for the evening given by a battalion of the French Guards to the Preobrazhensk battalion. The emperors were to be present at that banquet. Rostov felt so ill at ease and uncomfortable with Boris that when the latter looked in after supper, he pretended to be asleep, and early next morning went away, avoiding Boris. In his civilian clothes and a round hat, he wandered about the town, staring at the French and their uniforms, and at the streets and houses where the Russian and French emperors were staying. In a square, he saw tables being set up and preparations made for the dinner. He saw the Russian and French colors draped from side to side of the streets with huge monograms A and N. In the windows of the houses also, flags and bunting were displayed. Boris doesn't want to help me, and I don't want to ask him. That's settled, thought Nicholas. All is over between us, but I won't leave here without having done all I can for Denisov, and certainly not without getting his letter to the Emperor. The Emperor, he is here, thought Rostov, who had unconsciously returned to the house where Alexander lodged. Saddled horses were standing before the house, and the suite were assembling, evidently preparing for the Emperor to come out. I may see him at any moment, thought Rostov. If only I were to hand the letter direct to him and tell him all, could they really arrest me for my civilian clothes? Surely not. He would understand on whose side justice lies. He understands everything, knows everything. Who can be more just, more magnanimous than he? And even if they did arrest me for being here, what would it matter? Thought he, looking at an officer who was entering the house the Emperor occupied. After all, people do go in. It's all nonsense. I'll go in and hand the letter to the Emperor myself. So much the worse for Drubetskoy, who drives me to it. And suddenly, with a determination he himself did not expect, Rostov felt for the letter in his pocket and went straight to the house. No, I won't miss my opportunity now as I did after Austerlitz, he thought, expecting every moment to meet the monarch, and conscious of the blood that rushed to his heart at the thought. I will fall at his feet and beseech him. He will lift me up, will listen, and will even thank me. I am happy when I can do good, but to remedy injustice is the greatest happiness, Rostov fancied the sovereign saying. And passing people who looked after him with curiosity, he entered the porch of the Emperor's house. A broad staircase led straight up from the entry, and to the right he saw a closed door. Below, under the staircase, was a door leading to the lower floor. "Whom do you want?" someone inquired. "To hand in a letter, a petition to His Majesty," said Nicholas with a tremor in his voice. "A petition?" "This way to the officer on duty." He was shown the door leading downstairs. "Only it won't be accepted." On hearing this indifferent voice, Rostov grew frightened at what he was doing. The thought of meeting the Emperor at any moment was so fascinating and consequently so alarming that he was ready to run away. But the official who had questioned him opened the door, and Rostov entered. A short, stout man of about 30, in white breeches and high boots and a batiste shirt that he had evidently only just put on, was standing in that room, and his valet was buttoning onto the back of his breeches a new pair of handsome silk-embroidered braces that for some reason attracted Rostov's attention. This man was speaking to someone in the adjoining room.
A good figure and in her first bloom, he was saying.
But on seeing Rostov, he stopped short and frowned.
What is it? A petition? What is it?
Asked the person in the other room.
Another petitioner, answered the man with the braces. Tell him to come later. He'll be coming out directly. We must go.
Later, later. Tomorrow. It's too late. Rostov turned and was about to go, but the man in the braces stopped him.
Whom have you come from? Who are you?
I come from Major Denisov, answered Rostov.
Are you an officer?
Lieutenant Count Rostov.
What audacity! Hand it in through your commander, and go along with you, go.
And he continued to put on the uniform the valet handed him. Rostov went back into the hall and noticed that in the porch there were many officers and generals in full parade uniform whom he had to pass. Cursing his temerity, his heart sinking at the thought of finding himself at any moment face to face with the Emperor and being put to shame and arrested in his presence, fully alive now to the impropriety of his conduct and repenting of it, Rostov, with downcast eyes, was making his way out of the house through the brilliant suite when a familiar voice called him and a hand detained him.
"What are you doing here, sir, in civilian dress?" asked a deep voice.
It was a cavalry general who had obtained the Emperor's special favor during this campaign and who had formerly commanded the division in which Rostov was serving. Rostov, in dismay, began justifying himself, but seeing the kindly, jocular face of the general, he took him aside and, in an excited voice, told him the whole affair, asking him to intercede for Denisov, whom the general knew. Having heard Rostov to the end, the general shook his head gravely.
"I'm sorry. Sorry for that fine fellow.